Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 3rd of May. We devote our full 2 hours this morning to the death of bin Laden, the painstaking intelligence work, ask the question, who do we need to be afraid of now? Who are the leaders of Al-Qaeda? We will talk about Pakistan and their role that was played or was not played. It's increasingly controversial in this raid that killed Osama bin Laden, what it means for this country. And we have many guests with us for the next 2 hours. We're beginning this hour with Audrey Kurth Cronin, a professor at the National War College. Ron Suskind will join us later. Ron is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist who has written a great deal about the Bush war strategy in Afghanistan and later in Iraq. I'm sure he'll have a lot to say about what happened on Sunday. In the second hour of our program, we will also devote to a discussion of this momentous event. Professor Audrey Kurth Cronin has a really interesting background. She came to the U.S. National War College from Oxford University, where she was director of studies for the program on the changing character of war. She's a member of the War College faculty in Washington, D.C., and she was a specialist in terrorism at the U.S. Congressional Research Service Library of Congress, where she advised members in the aftermath of 9/11. She is author of a number of very pertinent books to our discussion, How Terrorism Ends, Ending Terrorism, A Strategy for Defeating Al-Qaeda. She has a longstanding interest in the question of how conflicts end and wrote her first book on the negotiations over Austria following the Second World War. That was titled Great Power Politics and the Struggle Over Austria. Recent publications include How Al-Qaeda Ends, International Security, Cyber Mobilization, The New Levy en Masse, Parameters Behind the Curve, Globalization and International Terrorism. Major studies for Congress include Designated Foreign Terrorist Organizations and Al-Qaeda After the Iraq Conflict and Terrorists and Suicide Attacks. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Audrey Kurth Cronin. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, as always, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Audrey Kurth Cronin, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Kathleen. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're delighted. You have such a background for our discussion. We're pleased to have you as a guest. Tell me about, in the order of everything, being able to get rid of bin Laden is incredibly important, just something that needed to be done, and we still have a lot more work to do. How do you take it all in?
Well, before I answer your question, let me also mention that one thing that's not in my bio is that I'm a daughter of two kids who grew up in Madison, Wisconsin. So I have a very warm spot in my heart for Wisconsin.
All right. We'll include that.
Excellent. Well, the importance of killing bin Laden is it can't be understated because it's a very important symbolic gesture, and also it has some operational relevance. But we have to look at the broader strategic picture when it comes to Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is a movement that has not just the core with bin Laden and Zawahiri, his number two, that core that's been located in that mysterious spot between Afghanistan and Pakistan. We still don't know exactly where Zawahiri is. But in addition to the core, we have affiliates and we have local individuals who are inspired by the message. So this is a very, very big, momentous, wonderful accomplishment not to have to worry about bin Laden himself. But we also have to, at the same time, remember that strategically speaking, there's a lot more to Al-Qaeda than just that core.
Right. Can you tell me a bit about the painstaking, it's been described as painstaking intelligence work that led to discovery of where he was, and the painstaking intelligence work that may be going on to try and determine where other people are and what their plans are?
Well, Kathleen, I'm not an intelligence officer, so I'm really only talking about what I read and how I interpret that as well, and just speaking for myself. But I do know that this has been the culmination of a very long process, that it began with just noticing that this was an unusual kind of a compound. And this is an important achievement. And in some respects, it shows the strides that we've taken with having our intelligence professionals work together well. So it certainly can be seen as a feather in the cap of our intelligence people. But as far as the details of how exactly they figured out how to find bin Laden, I think that's not going to be publicly released.
What about the material they were likely to have secured from his compound? Is it a treasure trove?
Well, I gather that it is, yes. They're going through it right now, and John Brennan is very, very excited about it. He appears to be very excited in his public appearances about what they're likely to find.
Mm-hmm.
It's been very useful to us, many of these operations that have brought back documents, but we aren't really going to know the specifics of what comes out of them probably for at least a period of weeks, if not months.
I'm interested in all that you have written. Let me just ask the question, and a large one it is, but you wrote a book on it, and you've written much about it, How Al-Qaeda Ends. Is our strategy coinciding with answering that question? How do we end Al-Qaeda?
Well, you know, there are a number of different patterns for the ways that different kinds of groups end, and what my book does is look at how groups have ended over the last couple of hundred years and then applies the lessons of those patterns and types of endings specifically to the question of Al-Qaeda. So the first pattern is what you might call decapitation, and that is the capture or killing of the leader, and this is what we just saw with the killing of bin Laden. But unfortunately, the conclusion that I came to after looking at many, many other case studies is that Al-Qaeda is not likely to end in this way. It's a movement that has developed a very broad network. It has several different levels of members. The key characteristics of groups that have ended through the killing of the leader are that first they're hierarchically structured, and even though Al-Qaeda was at some point more hierarchical than it is now, it's not a strictly hierarchical organization. It's very much more networked. It has a much more horizontal structure than it did, say, immediately after September 11th, so it doesn't fit the profile there. You usually have to have the lack of a viable successor to the leader. And bin Laden himself has put together a succession plan, and he has a number of people that could potentially act as a successor, although never at the same level of charisma. Usually groups that end through the decapitation of the leadership structure are much younger than Al-Qaeda is, so it doesn't fit, you know, the pattern there. But the final thing is that there has to be a cult of personality that gives the leader a particular following and a charisma, and Al-Qaeda does fit that element of a group that could end in this way.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would say is, overall, it's not likely to end the movement, but it is a serious blow, and it will be very hard to replace that cult, that focus upon bin Laden.
When you look at viable successors who may have some of the charisma, who may be as dangerous as bin Laden, who are you looking at?
Well, the people who come to mind immediately are, most important of all, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is an Egyptian, and he's the number two in Al-Qaeda. We see him appear in videos, and he's got a pretty broad presence on the web. He's always looked at as the most obvious successor to bin Laden. He certainly is playing that number two role. Many people consider him to be the kind of brains behind the operation right now. But there are a lot of weaknesses in Zawahiri. The first one is that he is indeed very much focused on Egypt. And the big changes that are going on in the Arab world, including those in Egypt, further marginalize him in his own native country. He's not as charismatic as bin Laden. He's not seen as having the same level of legitimacy. He's just not personably as likable. He seems very old-fashioned to a lot of the young individuals who get connected through the Internet. So, you know, he's not a new bin Laden. There's no question that Zawahiri is dangerous and can continue to pose a threat to the United States, but he's the most likely successor, and, you know, he's not really a replacement.
Mm-hmm.
Other people that some point to the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has a number of, that is the group in Yemen, has a number of folks that we're concerned about. Many Americans look at Awlaki, Anwar Awlaki. He's one of the most senior American citizens, and he's been connected to a number of high-profile attempts in the United States. But Awlaki is probably overstated in terms of his influence. He speaks English, and he gets a lot of attention among those who speak English, and he is a threat to the United States. But he's not as legitimate with people in the Arab world. He doesn't have the kind of, he's not proven himself in battle. He doesn't have that kind of sense of being a credible figure among some of the people that they're trying to reach. So Awlaki is important to us, but I wouldn't say that he's a very credible follower, successor to bin Laden. And there are other couple of other senior figures within what they call AQAP. The one that comes to mind is Abu Yahya al-Libi, who is a Libyan. We're really concerned about him because, of course, the situation in Libya is continuing to unfold. But, he, you know, he doesn't have the kind of widespread support that bin Laden had.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the people that come to my mind anyway. There are probably some other possibilities, but, you know, having bin Laden no longer in charge of this movement is a significant accomplishment.
And would there be some kind of procedure that would be followed now that perhaps bin Laden laid down? Should I die, here is how we announce the successor. This is the designated successor. Communication via internet or however they would communicate with each other. This is the person you should look to now. Should we expect that announcement somehow or not?
Yes, I would expect that Zawahiri will be the one who makes it. And I believe that he's already made a statement, but I haven't actually heard it. It's been very busy. So.
Yeah, it has been very busy. Yeah.
So I would look for something more from Zawahiri.
Where is he?
Well, if I knew the answer to that, I'd be very busy telling a lot of people. I think he's still in that same South Asia region, Afghanistan, Pakistan.
Uh-huh. It is. I was looking around to put together a timeline of Osama bin Laden for our shows today. It is amazing how many years all of this has gone on, isn't it? Starting with this network that bin Laden established in 1984 to recruit and establish fundraising offices in the Arab world, Europe, and the United States, the forerunner of al-Qaeda. That was many years ago.
Yes, that's true. But, Kathleen, if you don't mind, I'd like to go back to the question that you asked me about how al-Qaeda is likely to end.
Because, yes, sure.
Even though I've said that it's not likely to end through this operation, it's a very important operation, there are a couple of ways that it seems to be evolving. And when you look back at that long timeline, you can see some of the elements of bits of the patterns that other groups have gone through. The first sort of more promising pattern is through the failure of the movement, and groups tend to fail either through implosion, that is that they burn out and they collapse in upon themselves, or they lose popular support. And you see a very strong tendency for al-Qaeda to lose popular support among many of the people that they're trying to reach. If you've looked at any of the polls, particularly between about 2005 and 2009, there's been a real sharp drop, say, in the Pew Charitable Trust polling, and even in the Gallup polls, there's a sharp drop in support for al-Qaeda and for bin Laden himself that progresses right along over those years. So even though bin Laden himself has died right now, there's been an undermining of his public sort of ability to mobilize among the broader Muslim majority countries. And when you look at other similar kinds of groups, that's a positive development if you're looking at the end of al-Qaeda. And sometimes the reasons why people are no longer interested in supporting a group include things like bad targeting. That is, I mean, all terrorism is horrible targeting, don't get me wrong. But al-Qaeda has been trying to use terrorism in order to attract attention and to show strength and to get people inspired. But a lot of times what they've done is just made people extremely angry and to cause a backlash in local populations. And some of the countries that have been most heavily hit by targets that are associated with al-Qaeda are the very same countries that have had a sharp drop-off in interest and in support for folks like bin Laden. Pakistan comes to mind. I think the support for bin Laden at the last poll I looked at was something like 9%.
Oh, my.
So, you know, we in the United States have a tendency to just think about ourselves, and, you know, that's natural, that's very human. But what you see is a real erosion of support among the people that Al-Qaeda has been trying to reach, among the so-called Ummah, the Muslim community that they're trying to draw within their movement. And it's really been eroding for some time. And that's a positive development, I would say. There's a lot of infighting within Al-Qaeda on questions like whether it's okay or not to kill other Muslims or to call other Muslims apostates. You know, who decides who's an apostate and who's a devout Muslim, and attacking the economy of these countries. All of these have been extraordinarily disruptive and destructive of Al-Qaeda's message and its movement. So that's one pattern that's been underway for some years now, and it's a promising way for Al-Qaeda to end. But it won't be a dramatic end. It'll be more like a gradual petering out. And even when some groups are on the defensive and getting smaller in their support, they can still be extremely dangerous.
Well, and please factor in, and how important this is, how Al-Qaeda must be responding to these democracy movements. We've seen these extraordinary events in so many countries in the Arab world. It seems to me as though it would shake up Al-Qaeda. They would say, what the heck's going on here?
Oh, absolutely, Kathleen. I think it's been a big blow to Al-Qaeda in the sense that the movements have seemed to sideline their role and their message. So in a way, you could see the changes in Tunisia and Egypt as a kind of a perfect alternative narrative to the Al-Qaeda argument that the only way you can make change is through violence. Now, you have to be a little cautious when you say that, though, because revolutions don't occur overnight, and we have yet to see exactly how things are going to come out in Egypt, for example.
We welcome phone calls, and we'll take them momentarily. Our guest this half hour is Audrey Kurth Cronin. And she has written many, many books, How Terrorism Ends, Understanding the Decline and Demise of Terrorist Campaigns. She's a professor at the National War College, a member of the War College faculty in Washington, D.C., and also a non-residential senior research associate at Harvard. She, before that, Dr. Cronin, was specialist in terrorism at the U.S. Congressional Research Service Library of Congress. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls. Alan in Madison. Hi. Go ahead, Alan.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, please.
My question is, why is there so much money being spent on fighting terrorism and increasing our national security when thousands, hundreds of thousands of people are killed by automobiles every year in this country, die from cancer every year in this country, and we're putting all this money and blood into trying to deal with this so-called war on terrorism?
Well, it's a good question in the sense that I think in the wake of September 11th, there was a real trauma in our country and a deep hurt as a result of all the thousands of people that were killed. And as is the case in many similar states throughout history, you had a response that was extremely vigorous and a desire to use military force to respond to terrorism in an extremely powerful way. So some of this is as a result of the passions and hurt and response in the wake of September 11th, obviously. I think that we're getting to a point where we're realizing that military force is not an effective tool by itself. We're getting a little bit more balanced in the way that we carry out our counterterrorism policy. But, you know, one of the big elements in being able to be more balanced is to have your population understand that there is no such thing as zero risk when it comes to terrorist attacks. The United States is a great power, and it's likely that we're going to have a threat from Al-Qaeda and other groups that want to hurt us for years to come. And so part of what we need to do in order to have balance in how we spend our money and how we think about our security is to make sure that the American people remember that we're a very resilient country. and we're strong enough to understand that it's not possible to have perfect security. It's not possible to have zero risk. And when we have these attempts that are carried out, like the underwear bomber and some of the other attempts that have occurred with the attempt from Yemen to use the printer cartridges to blow up on airliners, these things are very, very serious and dangerous, but there's no such thing as being able to have perfect security, and we need to understand that.
Thank you, Alan. John in Madison, hi.
Good morning. I have, a follow-up to the question, did Pakistan know? And, you know, that will unfold in due course. I guess my question is the follow-up, which is, if you take at face value their answer, no, we did not know. Seems to me the relevant question then is, why not? What is it structurally within the military, the ISI, the political branch of Pakistan, or culturally? Why didn't they? Seems to me a very relevant question. The next thing I'd like you to, I guess, comment on is, you know, certainly the U.S. has interests, but it seems as though these countries, such as Pakistan, quite knowingly use their weakness or purported weakness as a strength, which is, if you force us to do X, that will so destabilize this incredibly fragile society that what you will get is worse. And that's a hell of a bind that we seem to be in with many of these countries where we have an interest, but seem to have very, very little actual influence. And I guess would like your comments on those.
Okay, thanks for the call, John.
Well, did Pakistan know? We don't know if they knew. This is the question that many people are asking, and I know that there's work going on right now to try to figure out the answer to it. So I don't have the answer either. And many in the American government are trying to figure that out. I think it is an important question. And secondly, on the issue of the role of Pakistan and the degree to which the United States has influence there, Pakistan, in my opinion, is one of the most, if not the most, dangerous place on Earth. It's a nuclear armed country, and they have quite a lot of domestic, they have a number of very dangerous domestic radical groups, quite apart from Al-Qaeda, some of them associated with Al-Qaeda. And so for the United States, it's a matter of choosing between many different options, all of which have a lot of drawbacks.
Thanks, Jerry, for the call. This is Jerry, too. Hi, Jerry, from Madison as well. Hi.
Oh, good morning, Kathleen. Following up on answer your guest gave previously, I believe that it's almost a certainty that there will be a retaliatory strike of some sort. But I was wondering, is President Obama himself under any increased danger because of this action?
I'm sure that the president is often under threat, and you know, they have a lot of people that follow the threats. I wouldn't be at all surprised. I don't have any direct knowledge of this, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if he's under increased threat and danger as a result of the action. Yes.
And what about what this action should do in terms of altering, if it should alter at all, U.S. foreign policy? Does this change our strategy in any way? Should it?
Well, I think the key place to look at in trying to answer that question, for me anyway, is what's happening in Afghanistan and our desire to begin to exit that country. We've been focusing very much on a counterinsurgency policy there, and this was an operation that was, a kind of a classic counterterrorism operation. It targeted the very people who had hit the United States, and was in response specifically to September 11th. So I think one of the questions that needs to be asked and will continue to be asked is, what's the future of our role in Afghanistan? Should we continue to play a role of counterinsurgents, which to some people makes us look as if we're occupiers? And unfortunately, can feed into some historical parallels with colonial powers.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where the debate's going to go.
And what about Pakistan? How they obviously haven't been the best of allies here, because somebody somewhere probably should have known what was going on. This whole thin line that they're walking of trying to keep terrorists from attacking them and civil war from breaking out there, and yet we need them to help us. How do you get them to be more of a helper? It seems to me as though that's quite difficult.
It's extremely difficult. Policy toward Pakistan is extraordinarily complicated and difficult. I mean, it needs to be said that the Pakistanis have lost quite a number of people fighting the same terrorists that we're concerned about in Pakistan. So it's not that they have not helped. That would be very, very unfair to say that they're not trying. But Pakistan is composed of many different elements, and it's oftentimes like untying the Gordian knot to try to figure out exactly which individual parts of Pakistan, the ISI, the military, the political elements, which groups are doing exactly what.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you know the answer to this. Finally, this is an email from Russ in Green Bay. It's been reported that bin Laden's DNA was positively identified. Do you know how our intelligence obtained a sample of his DNA against which to make positive identification?
No, I would only be speculating. I don't know the specific answer to that. I would guess they could do it from anything like a piece of hair or anything else. But no, I don't know that specific answer.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for being with us. And I hope we can call on you again.
Well, thank you very much, Kathleen. I've enjoyed it.
Our guest the first half hour of the show, Audrey Kurth Cronin, professor at the National War College, author of a number of pertinent books, How Terrorism Ends, Ending Terrorism, A Strategy for Defeating Al-Qaeda. She has a long-standing interest in the question of how conflicts end, and wrote her first book on the negotiations over Austria following the Second World War, and has strong Wisconsin roots. We continue our conversation. Actually, we have a full 2 hours on this death of bin Laden. And we are going to be in touch with people we were in touch with many years ago, actually. Ron Susskind will be joining us momentarily. I want to remind you that your phone calls are pertinent for the full 2 hours, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Tomorrow during this time period, we'll be in Madison for our one-day pledge drive, which we hope is wildly successful, and we'll have as our guests Ed Garvey and Bill Krause tomorrow. We're going to have a great conversation about all that's going on in Wisconsin and in the world. They're two of my favorite people, and it will be fun to talk with them in person in Madison, share a cup of coffee, and lots of ideas. Ron Susskind is joining us now. Ron is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and he's written a number of books that have to do with how the Bush administration handled the war on terror. The Way of the World, his book in 2008, which looked at the forces at home and abroad fighting today's battles for hope and security. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The 1% Doctrine, How the United States Government Improvised a Fight to Fight a New Kind of War After 9/11. He's also author of The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, The White House and the Education of Paul O'Neill, and A Hope in the Unseen, An American Odyssey from the Inner City to the Ivy League. It's been some time since we spoke with him. I'm sure he'll have some interesting things to say about the latest developments, the killing of bin Laden, and we'll welcome phone calls for him as well. Hi, Ron. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's nice to be with you.
Yeah, great to have you here. I know that you are quite an expert in how the Bush administration took on its pursuit of its enemies since 9/11. Did you notice a real difference between the administrations, the Obama and Bush administration, and how we're going to take on terrorism? Was there a complete difference in how various agencies got along with each other, how we were going to target somebody and successfully kill bin Laden? What are the differences?
Well, you know, there is surprising continuity, in fact, between the Bush and Obama administrations. I think that's been noticed by lots of people who felt there would be a very significant break. There's no doubt Obama had advantages, with that clean break and with the nature of Obama, with his profile, his personality, and ultimately the way he projected certainly a better presence across some of our most important friends or enemies around the world. And I think that we had some issues that had evolved during the Bush years. The coordination between the agencies, which was always a problem, and a problem certainly before 9/11, got better and better just by necessity over time. So that by the time Bush leaves, often against their will, these agencies were starting to work in better coordination across the intelligence community, certainly in the defense intelligence apparatus in total. So that by the time Obama gets there, there are opportunities. And I think one of the things you're seeing now in terms of this particular, extraordinary act, so well executed in terms of bin Laden, is that, intelligence is a pretty subtle thing. Intelligence assets, i.e. people telling you what you need to know before you actually need to know it, they come from all different places and for all different reasons. And I think that in part there is a change in terms of how people view the United States, with Obama at the top versus Bush for some of these folks far and wide. And I think my understanding is that our intelligence assets, so-called, have been augmented in the two-plus years of Obama's presidency, little by little. But meaningfully, as we see with the takedown of Obama.
When you heard that news on Sunday night, what were your thoughts? Did you think, well, it's about time, or this came as a total surprise? I didn't know if we were still after him. What was going through your mind?
Well, I mean, I've spent a decade with this story.
Yeah.
A couple books, a couple thousand, certainly a thousand-plus pages, let's just say. And part of me said, oh, gosh, we should have gotten him at Tora Bora. I said that for years. I had written in the 1% Doctrine, I think, kind of the definitive account of what happened in November and December of 2001, where we pretty much had him where we knew we could get him. But by virtue of just the thing you mentioned, the lack of coordination between, at that point, CIA and the Defense Department, and I think Bush's, confusion, maybe lack of clarity as to what was what, we let him slip away. Bush was briefed in November of 2001 that unless we applied 1,000 Marines, which could have been moved from elsewhere in Afghanistan to Tora Bora, our prey would get away. That's what Hank Crumpton at the CIA briefed him in the Oval Office. And he didn't do it. Tommy Frank said, no, we can't for this reason or that, and we have to rely on Afghan proxies, and it didn't work. And off bin Laden went to become really the symbol, as much as anything, that we ultimately, now reduced to immortality, if you will. At the end of the day, though, I know from my reporting that we've been looking for bin Laden in a kind of, oh, shucks, we let him get away, but let's see what we can do now fashion for many, many years. And we had very, very little in the way of a really solid lead as to where he might be. We were feeling and hunting in the dark for many years until about 2005, 2006, when we started to focus in on a courier that we picked up through some interrogation, but very generally the presence of this courier. We really didn't know who he was or how to find him. We did find him, some of it by happenstance. It wasn't a yield directly from interrogation, if you will. But ultimately, we got a break. And I think the key is that we used Pakistani proxies working for the CIA in Pakistan, i.e. not using ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Services, as our ally. We had our own people, though, from Pakistan working for us. And they were the ones who first identified the courier who led us to the compound that now is widely and well-known in Abbottabad.
I find myself, and I'm usually not that fascinated. I recently went to Gettysburg, and I became fascinated in the battles and the strategy there. But when you talk about how well executed this was, I'm just fascinated by this whole process that took place. And they didn't know for sure if he was going to be there, and the looks on the faces of the people in the Situation Room and these Navy SEALs doing this. It was quite an incredible act, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Wow. You know.
I have to say that I don't think there's anybody who doesn't feel a kind of pride and satisfaction of, oh, gosh, there are things we can do well.
Right.
And there it is, us doing it. You know, this these things often, you know, whether it's Black Hawk Down, whether it's Somalia, whether it's any number of U.S. attempts to do something heroic and I dare say cinematic.
Yeah.
You know, life is more complicated, and those complications have tended to stymie us. And here you show very, very clear planning, you know, and a kind of deliberate step-by-step kind of a set of insights that frankly, I think we were lacking often with the more impulse-driven Bush era, where Bush, you know, made it very personal. You know, this guy is a problem with my father, or I'm going to get this guy, or, you know, we need to, you know, act in some brutal, demonstrably brutal way to shape behavior. You know, things like that that I think Bush, you know, well-intentioned though he may have been, often got wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Here, hold on a second.
Okay.
And I think that what's interesting about this period is how important it was for us to, in a way, show what America can do here. Capability, the primacy of us doing well and doing right, and being effective was something that I think people missed during some years, in which, well, the world seemed more complicated than our ability to wrestle it into coherence. and I think that's why people are feeling very very upbeat about watching mm-hmm. this extraordinary execution. And it was extraordinary.
It was.
Letter and verse. Remember, Obama found out about the compound and bin Laden last August. So there was a great deal of time in which there was deliberation as to what exactly to do. And military leaders in the United States advised Bush to, you know, just bomb it into a crater. And, of course, that is often the U.S. response. And Obama said, I think we can do something that's more effective and a much better outcome than that. And ultimately, in this case, as opposed to some of the issues in Afghanistan, Obama prevailed, and the outcomes, in fact, were quite extraordinary.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about Afghanistan and Iraq, because you spent so many books, thousands of pages, looking at all of this. May 1st, 2003, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld announces an end to major combat in Afghanistan, 2003. We switch our focus to Iraq. We got to play a little bit of how things may have been different and what we need to do now as a result of this. So we've got a strong presence in Afghanistan. We're still sort of in Iraq. Can you play that out for us a little bit, why that decision was made and how wrongheaded it may have been, and how Obama needs to perhaps deal with a new strategy in Afghanistan?
Well, you know, it's clearly going to be one of history's crossroads decisions, and it'll be examined and reexamined 1,000 times, I think, in the years to come. What's important and clear now, what the evidence shows, are two very important things, is that the invasion of Iraq ultimately was not caused by the 9/11 attacks. It was planned from literally the very first National Security Council meeting of the Bush presidency. As members of that Security Council, members, folks in that room were called. It was simply a matter of how do we do it? How do we get Saddam? Bush felt it was unfinished business, some of it having to do with his father's administration. He was advised that somehow Iraq was the destabilizing force in the region, though very few people agreed with that in the foreign policy establishment. So So what's important is this notion of find me a way to do it. Because what happens is that after 9/11, when really the clock gets reset in terms of America recognizing the real issues that we face in this era, still the advisors around President Bush, you know, who never had a particularly strong grasp of foreign affairs, were saying this is the chance we've been looking for. And they pressed that point rather consistently right from the start after the 9/11 attacks. And the view was, as soon as we have the chance, let's move these forces over to the real mark, which is Iraq. Iraq, which is a pressure point in terms of oil, a pressure point in terms of various strategic issues in the region. Let us create a democracy there that'll be friendly to the United States in a very kind of pan-American kind of strategy, very audacious, every bit as audacious as the domino theory, maybe more so. And so as soon as they had opportunity, they started to shift forces to Iraq. Before the job in Afghanistan, mind you, one of the most perilous, countries and terrain on the planet, which has been a country where many empires have met great woes. Here we have an actual foreign engagement. We haven't had one of those really significantly since the Vietnam War. And here we are in Afghanistan, and already they're pushing this sort of broad, sweeping ideology of transforming the world, and Iraq is at the center of that. Now, what that meant was that we start to divert our attention and our forces as of November of 2001. As soon as Kabul starts to teeter, we start to say, all right, what's next? Instead of thinking clearly, why are we here, what are our objectives, how will we achieve them, and then how will we exit, which is what Colin Powell was pressing. As a general, that's what generals say. What are we doing here, how are we going to do it, and how are we going to get home? Instead, it was a jumble of competing ideologies, of sort of, you know, sweeping thoughts by people who had never been in a theater of combat, like Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz. And ultimately what happens is that our prime objective there, which is to get Osama bin Laden, gets reduced as a priority. And we do not keep our eye on the ball, and we let him slip away in Tora Bora. The Pakistani forces never get there, as they say they're supposed to, in terms of guarding that border against something that was just, you know, left to the vagaries of they say they're supposed to, and who's going to tell Musharraf otherwise, and all of those things were part of a strategic blunder in letting bin Laden escape. And ultimately what it did was, by virtue of that being set publicly as our objective for being in Afghanistan, it started us down a path as to us clearly, demonstrably not fulfilling our objectives. And thereby, we end up in a deepening quagmire in Afghanistan without a real clear goal of what it is we're doing there, what is the hope, and the outcome that's desired in terms of all the treasure and blood of young men and women being spilled. And that's how we end up there 10 years later.
All right, and we'll ask what the end game may be there in a moment. I want to take phone calls. Ron Susskind is our guest. He is the author. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and he's the author of a number of books. We interviewed him on the important ones, particularly looking very, very carefully at the Bush administration and the war in Afghanistan, to the war in Iraq, to the global search for jihadists, the 1% solution, just one of his books. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phone calls now for Ron Susskind. Brandon in Baraboo. Hi, Brandon.
Hello. Excellent program. And I guess my question would be, do you think speculatively that Pakistan was possibly left out of the loop to save face in the Middle East? Pakistan in the last 10 years has been considered more of a devil's advocate than ally, as well as a nuclear power. Do you think there could be a deliberate media strategy to leave Pakistan not only chastised by the Western powers, but also respected by more aggressive fundamentalist groups still within Pakistan, basically to we left you behind. We didn't keep you in the loop, but you know, and you're still safe.
Mm-hmm. Run.
Let's just talk. I think your story, your question in general, is about the quagmire and dilemmas of Pakistan and the U.S. relationship with Pakistan. And let me just sort of offer an end game of that, which might, I think, speak to your question, is that we have been part of what we suspected for years was what you call a double play from Pakistan. Let me just put a fine point on it. When I was with Benazir Bhutto and Asif Zardari, her husband is now the president, in 2007, and some of their advisors, I was pressing them on the point of how is it possible that here we are 6-7 years after 9/11, and so little assistance has been provided by Pakistani intelligence, namely ISI, in terms of getting Osama bin Laden. And let's just say I was told in a kind of, you know, I'm sure you understand this. If you don't, here's the deal. Basically they said, if you catch Osama bin Laden, you will be out of the region, our region, with all of your support and your money and your humanitarian aid and certainly your support for our military in a New York minute. So let's just say it may not be in our core interest to help you find bin Laden anytime soon. And I think that's always the thing that we suspected. I think it is, in fact, probably the case of what occurred. You know, over in South Asia, you know, they have a line that nothing happens on the tabletop. It all happens beneath the table. You need to understand how those deals are cut. And frankly, I think the key to this mission working so well is that we were very judicious, the United States was, in keeping the Pakistani intelligence services in the dark. That's why it worked, and the Pakistani military.
Yeah.
And because of that, and because of us developing capabilities that we can move unilaterally and manage that situation, I think that that we had a success. So, Pakistan is a troubling friend, a frenemy, as you know, some of the teenagers say, because in one hand we have things like this happening to us, where we give them $10-11 billion a year in aid, including $1 billion a year simply to get Osama bin Laden for counterterrorism, and ultimately, it seems as though he was more than hiding in plain sight. The compound was a block from their version of West Point, you know, visited just a month or two ago by Kiani, the head of their military. Literally, he's a nine-iron shot away from where bin Laden is sitting. This doesn't happen by accident. And the United States is stymie because, on one hand, I know they're aggrieved about this. On the other hand, they say Pakistan has 70-plus nuclear weapons, and we need to stay engaged with that country no matter how often we get our noses bloodied. And no doubt, this is a great victory for the United States in finally getting bin Laden, not in spite of Pakistan's, or not because of Pakistan's help, rather, but I think in spite of it.
Thanks, Brandon. Willem in Colfax. Hi.
Hi. I had a couple of comments. One was about Seymour Hersh. At the time, had written an article about how the Pakistani intelligence and was all tangled up in this escape of bin Laden from Tora Bora. And the other thing I wanted to comment on was a week or so ago, I read a comment by Al Baradei that he thought that Bush should be brought up as a war criminal. And I think the problem with the way that the war was fought goes back to the War Powers Act and the sort of abdication of the Congress to give up their constitutional oversight in declaring war. I know no war was declared, but somehow all this should have been more of an open government instead of all this secret planning and secret dealing, which engages a lot of U.S. lives and a lot of money.
We have about a minute left. Ron?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think what you're dealing with very broadly is a distinction between the almost institutionalized secrecy that dominated the Bush administration and a bit of question on that matter. Not a lifting of it by Obama, but certainly I think an easing of it, and an understanding that you need some transparency and you need to ultimately win some of these battles when it comes to issues of war in the court of public opinion. War without consent of the governed never works in a democracy, certainly. And I think right now that's the discussion that will go forward as to whether we stay in Afghanistan, or if so, for how long.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ron, so much for being. Are you working on a new book, sir?
Oh, sure. Always a book.
Always
a
book.
There'll be another one out in a few months. I'll alert you guys.
Please.
Don't worry.
Please do. Thanks, Ron. Ron Suskind, Pulitzer Prize-winning author. We have interviewed him about many of his books, The 1% Solution, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11. And he's written a number of other books as well. Thanks to Chrissy Pease and Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Rhonda for doing on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Considering the momentous nature of the news the last couple days, we are going to continue on this topic. We'll have two different guests with us to talk about the death of Osama bin Laden, strategy now with Pakistan and Afghanistan and other terrorist groups that we need to be worried about. So all of that will continue right after the latest news.